Case number 19-3824, United States of America versus Derek Grant. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Grieve, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Anna Grieve for appellant Derek Grant. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court. In one sentence, the Sixth Circuit in Bedford endorsed a monumental expansion of the federal government's ability to prosecute crime. Consider the following. The Northeast Ohio Correctional Center, where Derek Grant was housed, does not hold only federal prisoners. It holds state prisoners, too. What happens if two prisoners, one federal and one state, collectively assault a core civic employee? And I would ask Ms. Letzko, would the government charge both under the federal assault statute? If so, this statute is even more wildly expansive than contemplated by Bedford. But if not, it shows that application of this statute does not turn on any action of the core civic employee, but rather depends only on the status of the prisoner. Your Honors, I'd like to turn to the text of the statute.
We don't have to come to grips with your state prisoner.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Come to grips with your state prisoner example in this case?
No, Your Honor, we don't. But it does show a problem with the government's theory. Now, Your Honors, as to the text of the statute, I've made numerous arguments about the text in my brief. And rather than simply reiterate those points, now I'd like to make two additional observations. First, under the government's theory, words in the statute are superfluous. Now, the government says, and the government is right, that agencies act only through natural persons. But the government then takes that one step too far. When you look at the statute, of course, both officers and employees individually refer to natural persons. So if the government is right that you can simply substitute in an agency, the government would be right if the statute said either officer or either employee. But the statute...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can I ask you, I find your textual argument interesting, but isn't the U.S. Marshal in this case contracting with the prison to perform its duties? So just to summarize from the statute, it's really acting to assist the U.S. Marshal who signs the contract, who tries to accomplish the duties. And if you look at the statutory history, as you point out, I think in your initial brief, but also you mentioned in your reply, the statutory history at one point included U.S. Marshal and they summarized it or changed it to officers and employees.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, you're right. The former version of the statute did include those employed to assist marshals and assistant marshals. And I think the fact that the statute no longer includes that word is significant. Now, employed to assist is broader than simply assisting because you have that specific, the specific limit set forth by the words an officer and employee. Employed to assist is broader because when you're employed to assist someone, you're really not assisting specific officers or specific employees. If you're employed to assist the Marshal Service, well, there are no particular federal personnel at issue.
Why aren't you assisting here the United States Marshal? In other words, the United States Marshal is tasked with transporting, protecting, doing all the things they have to do to get a prisoner to and from court and house them. And here you are assisting the United States Marshal in the performance of such duties. In other words, it's clear the Marshal's duties encompass this.
Well, so, Your Honor.
Go ahead. I'm sorry,
Your Honor. We agree that the core civic employee here was assisting the Marshal Service generally, but that's not enough under the statute because under that interpretation, that's what leads to this huge expansion of the federal government's power. That's what the Supreme Court has said in Bond and Ruiz and all those cases, that it simply won't adopt such a broad interpretation without a clear signal from the statute.
Help explain why it's such a broad expansion. Just to make sure I'm getting your point, if you count as the contract, a contract with this individual, with the Marshal Service, the agency, that's what creates the big expansion?
The expansion, Your Honor, is how many contracts the federal government has with private entities. Now, as I said, I couldn't figure out how many businesses the federal government contracts with, but it's at least 3,500. Now, if you look at those 3,500 private...
Wouldn't it be limited by in the performance of such duties, so it would have to be their core function?
No, Your Honor, that's a separate, excuse me, that would be a separate limit on the statute. So
that's good.
Yes, Your Honors, it is, but it's not the limit that we're worried about here. So the problem is that when you have all of these
your contract worry is I'm worried that by contracting the government expands everything. Why doesn't that limit it to just the core functions of those officers or employees, which this clearly comes within?
Well, Your Honors, if you think that's the appropriate, well, that limit here really isn't a limit at all. If you're going to bring in people who simply have a contract with a government agency, then if they're ever working in their job, they're always working within the scope of that official duty. So it's not a real limit because, in essence, if they're working within the scope of that contract, that's always necessarily going to be in the performance of satisfying in the performance of the official duties prong.
You know, I'm not one known to be unsympathetic to federalism arguments, but I just don't see the problem with a statute that's about assaulting federal officers. That's in the main, and that it includes people hired to help federal officers. So that just doesn't strike me as unusual. I don't even care. I wouldn't care if it was 100,000 of these subcontracts. It's still about a federal, it's a federal function.
Your Honor, I don't think it's a federal function here. Remember, the goal of the federal government isn't to make money imprisoning people, but that is CoreCivic's goal. The federal government, for whatever reason, doesn't want to run these prisons themselves. For whatever reason, the government has made these prisons more separate and more apart from the federal government.
Well, I think as one of your briefs explained, the government just doesn't have, I mean, they house, as you know, all pretrial prisoners in state prisons, except in unique areas where there are federal pretrial detention centers. But there are very few nationwide. So it's not that they don't want to, they just don't have the capacity.
Well, Your Honors, I think that might be confusing cause and effect a little bit. The Bureau of Prisons has had these contracts with CoreCivic for decades now. Perhaps the federal government never increased its capacity to hold these people because it had this ability to contract it out. If CoreCivic never came into existence, I'm sure the federal government would have found a way to house all the people that it needed to house.
Now, why would the government care whether an individual is physically helping another federal officer or just helping the agency at large? Why would Congress write a statute that distinguishes between the two when the ultimate result or function is the same?
Your Honor, this goes back to basic principles. It's not the role of the federal government to generally police. The federal government doesn't have the general police power. The states hold that. The federal government can prosecute people, but only as a means of furthering one of its functions as set forth in the Constitution. So you have to be careful and make sure you're not giving the federal government a police power beyond what it's allowed to have. So I agree.
Here the power is protecting and holding inmates until their process is finished. That's clearly,
yes,
that's
Your Honor.
Core function. I just don't know why the Congress would write a statute saying if you're physically there assisting an actual federal employee, you're protected. But if you're contracted at large to do the exact same thing, you're not.
Well, Your Honors, consider facts different from this case. I think it's a little hard to separate a CoreCivic employee from a Bureau of Prisons prison guard. But the problem with Bedford and the problem with the interpretation here is that you're not only limited to this situation. I gave numerous examples in my brief. Basically, the Bedford court said that if you're doing something the federal government otherwise would have done, you're covered under the text of the statute. But where does that limit end? The government couldn't even articulate an end to it. So while the facts here might not be the most sympathetic, and while you might want, there are facts in other situations which would make it more clear that this is a problem, that the federal government really can prosecute simple assault in a way that you wouldn't think they should be able to do, in a way that the
state normally would have power. Give me your favorite example. What's your favorite example? It has nothing to do with prisons. What's the one when you hear it, you just almost chuckle. Go ahead.
Well, Your Honors, I liked my farmer example. Prisons have to have food. They have to feed the prison inmates. If the government couldn't contract with farmers to grow that food, then presumably a federal employee would have to do it. It really just shows that every person who tangentially works with the Bureau of Prisons is going to be covered under the interpretation here. Now, Your Honors, there are many cases.
One question about Bedford before you finish, because I find it hard to get around this case, even with your very thoughtful brief. And this language from Bedford is what trips me up. It seems to be this is the core language. It is well established that private employees who subject to government contracts perform work that federal employees would otherwise do, and in doing so further the interests of the federal government, fall within the ambit of 1114. I mean, if you have a private postal worker who's delivering mail pursuant to a government contract, how do we get around that? What's the difference here?
Are you asking, are you bound by Bedford? How can we get around Bedford? Am I understanding that question?
Yeah, well, we're clearly bound by it, right? It's published. So how do we get around it so you can win without us going en banc?
Well, Your Honors, unfortunately, I think if you think Bedford is binding, it binds us here. However, I think Bedford is wrong. I see that I'm almost out of time. May I answer your question?
He's trying to say, is there a way to distinguish it here?
Well, Your Honors, again, may I answer quickly?
Yeah.
Thank you. Your Honors, I would think the one distinction in Bedford is that at issue there was the Postal Service. Now, while the federal and the state government share many concurrent goals, delivery of the mail is one that is one that's exclusively federal. Mm-hmm. I would say that's a distinction in these cases.
So currency, mail, military, okay.
Protection of, yeah.
All right, we'll hear from the government and you'll get your full rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Rebecca Lutzko from the Northern District of Ohio on behalf of the United States. For three reasons, this court should affirm the conviction of Derek Grant for assaulting his prison guard who was assisting United States Marshals in performing their official duties via contract while Grant was in federal custody. Those three reasons are, first, Derek Grant either waived or forfeited his claims by not raising them sufficiently below. And regardless of the standard of review here, the court has recognized, its earlier decision in Bedford fully binds this panel. And third, Bedford aside, the plain language of Section 1114 forecloses Grant's claims. Now, starting briefly with the standard of review, the government in here argued primarily forfeiture, although noted also a waiver argument as well. As the court is well aware, waiver is an intentional abandonment of a known right.
Can you grapple with your friend on the other side's argument in their reply brief on plain error that, hey, the government filed a motion in limine and the court ruled before I could respond. And once they filed a motion in limine, I mean, it's essentially an objection. You can't preclude a defendant from responding in rule.
Well, essentially, there's a couple of points there, Your Honor. So first of all, as you're well aware, a motion in limine is only a preliminary ruling. It is not a final ruling by the district court. It is simply what the court would admit, it believes it would admit in evidence. But second and more importantly here is the defendant here didn't do two things that he could have done. First of all, you're correct that timing-wise, the motion in limine was filed and the court ruled the following day. But nothing prevented the defendant here from filing a motion to reconsider and making arguments.
So do they have to do that every time a trial court rules against them in order to avoid plain error? They have to file a motion to reconsider? Do you have any authority for that?
Well, yes, certainly to when they plead. So here, the defendant under Rule 11, the defendant pleaded and guilty, and when the defendant did not do so conditionally. In Bedford involved a motion to dismiss an indictment, and then followed by a conditional plea of preserving the argument. That is not what was done here, and. The defendant under Rule 11 is required to identify a particular motion that he or she wants to appeal. And so that was not done. So the government does believe that waiver would be an appropriate finding of this court. However, I think more to the point is really the government argued this primarily as a forfeiture argument and as a forfeiture of the right because the defendant did not file the motion. And under Rule 12 and this court's Mullet decision at 822 F3rd 842, specifically 847 through 48, which was a 2016 case, they noted that under Rule 12B3B, it requires that any challenge to the indictment, including a claim that it fails to state an offense, must be made before trial or the claim is considered forfeited and may only be excused for good cause. And that's essentially, it's the government's position that that's what this argument is, that this is a claim that the indictment did not, wasn't sufficient, did not fully state an offense.
Can I move you to your third argument? I just
absolutely
have one quick question. So I want to use your friend's example. So a farmer in Mexico, all they do is supply a federal prison across the border. Someone assaults them while they're gathering food that crops, whatever, bananas that would come to the prison. You're saying, and obviously the federal prison has a responsibility to feed employees. It's a core function, feed their inmates. That's a core function. You're saying that would be covered by this law?
Your Honor, do not need to decide such an extreme case here. As you are well aware, these cases are decided on a fact by fact basis.
You just said it was extreme. Where's the line of extreme?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we look here, this case is nothing even close to an extreme case. And maybe extreme was an improper choice of words. But nonetheless, here we've got, as Judge Thapar pointed out, a core function of the United States Marshal Service, which is to house and to arrest prisoners.
Feeding inmates is a core function of the BOP. And so... And you called it extreme. Where's the line?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the line is, as Bedford set out, it would be whether there's a contract with the federal government. And so while it might be, maybe extreme was a poor choice of words.
Okay, the farmer in Mexico would be covered. There's a contract with the farmer who's supplying food to the prison.
I'll answer Judge Thapar's question. I would have thought there might be some lines here that are not that unusual, including that it's not probably typical for the Bureau of Prison to contract with the Nebraska, Mexican, Utah farmer. That is not, I'm going to guess, how this works. So.
And quite honestly, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that, of how the Bureau of Prisons does contract in order to, you know, obtain its food sources. But I do know that the U.S. Marshals across the country almost exclusively contract with local prisons in order to do pretrial detention, because that's their responsibility. They don't.
But what about one I know for sure, because Judge Sutton raises a good point. So what about GSA contracting with landscapers around a prison, so that the grass gets cut, people can get into the prison, the area around it's kept clean? They get assaulted. It come within the ambit of this?
Yes. Yes.
So it does seem like it reaches pretty far, maybe all 3,500 government contracts, as your friend points out.
But nonetheless, it's not so that, as the appellant pointed out here, the focus here is that she's espousing here is different than the focus of her initial argument. So she's talking about what Congress has the power to contract, criminalize here. And that's more of a Commerce Clause question. And that's not really what's been teed up before this court. The question was whether this statute reached private employee who is under contract to perform the official duties of a government agency.
In Judge Thapar's example, does it matter if the private landscaper who's helping out is assaulted by an inmate who jumps the fence, or someone on the street who just walks up and doesn't like the landscaping works and decides to assault the private contractor or landscaper? Is either person, both persons, each person is equally guilty of violating the statute?
Well, I have to think that the case that's coming to mind is the Matthews case, where I believe it was the Second Circuit had a, it involved the United States Marshals in a forfeiture context, had a house and had a person installing drywall, and that person was assaulted while they were performing federal functions and under a federal contract. And so without giving it a significant amount of thought, I don't think it would matter whether it was the federal prisoner that jumped the line or whether it was someone on the street who was working for the federal government under contract. I don't know that landscaping is a core function of the U.S. Sure. Marshal Service either.
Well, I don't know. I don't know where, what part I have in this little drama, but I'll play it no matter what. I don't understand the pause here. Why in the world is it inappropriate if it's federal property to protect the people looking after the federal property? I mean, just forget the federal government. Let's just talk about a state. Let's say the state of Ohio says the exact same statute. What is wrong with protecting people that are state employees or contract with the state to perform state functions? If that means looking after the property of the state, cutting the grass, and they're assaulted while in the performance of such duties, go for it. It's not that huge an expansion because this doesn't happen very often. What's significant is it's a state interest. And if the states can do it, the feds can do it with their function. So I don't see much drama with any of the hypotheticals. The farmer in Mexico strikes me as really implausible because I just don't think that's how it works. The state of Ohio is not known for growing the food for its inmates. I don't think the federal government is either. So that's the answer. But if it's a state or federal function, so be it. Why can't you protect these people while they're doing that function? There's nothing to run from, is what I'm saying.
And Congress has every interest in protecting not only its employees, but the people that it contracts with. So I would agree with Your Honor. I don't think it's anything to run from, but I do think, you know, where you draw that line, I think Bedford showed you where you draw that line, in particular in the things that Bedford rejected. For instance, if they cited the Reed case and the Sapp case, where they talked about an inadvertent assisting of the federal government, as opposed to something was directed in a relationship and under a contract. There, I believe a police officer in one situation showed up before the FBI was ever there and was assaulted. In the other, I believe there was a separate state investigation. And in those situations, the federal government is not working in tangent with the state, and therefore doesn't have that same federal function, federal interest in protecting those people as it does when in fact it is contracting with, directing, working together with a person to further a federal purpose.
What about the language of the statute itself that says such an officer in the performance of such duties, and your friend's argument that's referring to a specific officer or employee, and here there is no specific officer or employee?
Thank you, Your Honor. So that I think is the third reason why that forecloses this argument. That language, or the grant here, attempts to take the word and isolate it completely from the rest of the statute. My opponent even says that it would be okay if it said any such officer or employee, but that's essentially what that statute says. When you read that statute in context, 114, when it says assisting such an officer or employee, you have to look back to what it is referring to, which is the first sentence of that statute, who says whoever kills or attempts to kill any officer or employee of the United States or of any agency. And so what that is not an individual, but it's any. And so what it reads, if you look at the reference to such and, what it really reads
I'm not sure I follow. So you're saying replace such and with any, assisting
Correct.
Any officer or employee?
Correct, because the such and refers to the beginning of the statutory language, which says whoever kills or attempts to kill any officer or employee of the United States any. Or a brand. While, I'm sorry?
They knew how to use any. If you look at what after a while such officer, meaning a particular officer or employee, is engaged in account of a performance of official duties or any person assisting such an officer. It doesn't say any officer. It says such an, which seems to me is referring to a specific officer. That's the argument.
Well, that's the argument, and it might have some merit if it were that phrase simply in isolation. But the such an, it's a government's position, refers to the any officer or employee, because they first, the statute first describes any officer or employee.
You're losing Judge Thapar when you add words that aren't in there, right? It doesn't say it's your argument's right, but you keep saying it the wrong way. It's an employee of the United States or of any agency. The any is correct. There.
Correct.
Okay.
I apologize for not being clear, but yes, any is there, and that such an officer is referring back to any officer or employee of the United States or of any agency. So it's the government's position that not only does Bedford foreclose this court based on the fact that it addressed both prongs of the defendant's argument here, it forecloses this panel from reaching a different conclusion in this case, but that the plain language of this statute forecloses the argument as well. So for all of these reasons, the United States respectfully requests that this court affirm the conviction of Derek Grant for assaulting a prison guard while he was assisting the United States Marshals in the performance of their official duties.
All right. Thank you. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. In United States v. Farr, 673 Federal Appendix 476, this court held that an explicit and definitive ruling on the record for a motion in limine without any indication that the ruling was conditional was sufficient to preserve an objection. Now, Your Honors, touch on a crucial point, I think. So it's hard to...
Counsel, I just want to show you how broad I think this is, and you just tell me what I'm missing. What's a duty or an issue that the federal or state government cares about is up to them. If the federal government decides to go into the business of farming or making cars, go for it. They get to define what is public and what it is the government's going to do, including being oddly socialist.
But sure, Your Honor.
Once they do that, you're not allowed to try to kill people doing the function. That's as simple as that.
Sure, Your Honor, but there are practical constraints on the federal government and its ability to expand. There is limited time, there's limited resources, they have limited political power. So I think in your hypothetical, you're imagining that the federal government has no limitations on how it could expand when that's not true in the practical world. Now, Your Honor's questions
I quite agree. The Commerce Clause limits them, but once they have the power, once there's no Commerce Clause challenge, it's whatever they want to do.
Yes, Your Honor.
Restraints, but once they decide to do it, the statute's allowed to criminalize folks that try to kill the people doing the public service.
Your Honor, for whatever reason, the federal government doesn't want to run these prisons. It wants to contract with a private entity to do so. I can't speak to their reasoning or the why they want to do it this way, but they've made that choice, and the plain text of the statute simply doesn't cover this situation. Now, Your Honors, you touched on an important point. It seems hard to figure out what it means to be a federal function. Now, we keep saying federal function. Precedent says it, opposing counsel said it. What does it mean to be a federal function? It's really unclear. And in fact, the state and the federal government often share many of the same goals, besides a few small things that are specifically reserved for the federal government. So how can you really say most things are a federal function when the states further the similar goals as well? Another point, Your Honors, these people would not be unprotected if you hold that this statute doesn't apply. Ohio has an assault statute, ORC 2903.13. Under Ohio, this would be a misdemeanor of a first degree with a possible jail sentence of up to 180 days. You're not leaving the people to the wolves if you recognized that the plain text of the statute doesn't support this situation here. Now, Your Honors, another point, Bedford.
So I guess the one problem there is that the federal government is leaving charging decisions for injuries caused to people who are clearly agents of the federal government to the state. Certainly the federal government has an understandable prerogative in wanting to prosecute those people themselves.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps, but if they really wanted to do so, why not run these prisons themselves? Why contract with a for-profit corporation? They don't want to run these prisons. I don't know why. But Your Honors, another point on Bedford. Bedford never actually addressed this argument. So if this court holds that Bedford is binding in this situation, it would be allowing this court's jurisprudence in the context of sensitive federal-state relationships to be dictated by silence and the fact that the appellant in Bedford didn't raise this argument, didn't allow the court to address it. Such important questions shouldn't be dictated by silence. Your Honors, unless you have any further questions, I think I've said what I wanted to say.
Thanks to both of you. We really appreciate your super helpful briefs and arguments. Thanks for answering our questions, and we're really grateful to your advocacy. Thanks so much.